Hello, everybody, and welcome to the very 291st episode of the Shut Up and Sit Down podcast, a podcast that's been about board games the whole time.
Yeah, right. Twist. Big twist. You step out of the shower and it was all a board game.
Yeah. On this episode, we're going to the seaside.
It's the seaside special.
The seaside special.
The big wet one you've all been waiting for.
Featuring the lovely, charming, bucolic energy of Tenby, a game about building out little houses by the seaside, and an equally seaside retreat type game, Thesaurus,
yes.
A game about diving into the briny deep to receive treasure and shooting sharks with harpoons.
Yes.
Yeah. They've got, they're the same.
They're the same sort of thing. And basically, you know, they're the two types of holidays, really. The two types of seaside holiday. Are you going to have a nice, quaint time, walk down the docks, get an ice cream?
Or are you going to have an action holiday?
Yeah, or are you going to buy a rocket-powered, some sort of harpoon gun and murder as many sea creatures as possible?
I know which I'd prefer.
Right?
Let's podcast.
Let's go.
First up on this podcast, we're going to talk about Thesaurus. This is a game from 2025 designed by Cedric Millet with art by Oscar Manuel, Jan Valiani, and published by Super Meeple. And it is a game in which, according to the BGG description, you must optimize your search for sunken treasure whilst managing your company.
Right.
That's pretty accurate.
Yeah, I guess it is. It's a game of having little people that you place onto a board.
Oh my goodness.
Workers, if you will.
I've heard this one before.
Little workers that you place onto the board. And there are limited spaces to place them. Ooh. And when you place those workers, you get to do a thing.
I love doing things with the workers.
The thing about this one, though, is you can do things in the sea.
Mm-hmm.
And also, it's one of those games where rather than placing a thing on a space and doing it, we all place all of our people and then we carry out all of the actions in one big chain reaction.
Yes. Yeah. I also love, I just want to go back a second there. I love that you were like, in this worker placement game, you can put your workers in the sea. Like, all other worker placement games, you're placing them on land, probably.
Yeah, a lot of the time.
It's maybe in space.
It's frowned upon to just drop your workers into the
in
sea.
In this one, they can go for a dip.
So, I mean, this board basically features lots of different spaces. But yeah, as you say, you're going to be getting boats. You're going to be taking boats out into the sea. You're going to be going and finding treasure maps. You're going to be then finding treasure chests in the sea. Or maybe on a little island in a jungle with metal detector. It could happen.
It could happen to you.
You're going to be taking them to a museum because that's where they belong.
Mm-hmm.
And getting cash and glory
for
doing so.
Reputation.
But the way that the game works is kind of interesting in the fact that every player board in front of you has like this little office with like a bunch of different rooms in it. And partially that's these rooms are for storing your resources and storing things like your equipment for your boats.
Your treasure maps.
Your employees.
Your many dead sharks.
Thinking about it, it's kind of funny that you have this office space that has like 10 rooms in it and you all of your employees just are in one.
Yeah.
Put all of the employees in this one corner of the office. It's like, can we go in the other rooms?
And one room is just for a giant, ominous black cube.
Yes, it is.
Talk about that in a second.
We'll come back to that in a little bit. But I like the way that this game forces you to make bad decisions. In the fact that you can't actually do actions without spending money to do them.
Mm-hmm.
And you have these five rooms at the bottom of the board, or maybe four rooms, I can't recall.
I think it's four or five.
It's four or five.
It's somewhere in the four to five range.
And these are the different types of actions you can do. If you don't have money in that room, when you get to come to do the action, then you're in trouble.
Yes.
And so at the start of each year, and there are 3 years you play,
each
year has four rounds, you are going to be like putting your budget into these rooms and trying to work out like what your spending is going to be for like research, boat stuff,
paying your people
and hiring new people, which was a really fun little puzzle.
Yeah, you do it all at the top of the year. You kind of have to like allocate your budget correctly. And it genuinely feels a little bit like running a small business when you go, well, this is all the money that I've allocated to pay my workers.
Mm-hmm.
And now I can think about what I actually want to do with the rest of the money. and it's probably going to be buy a new cool scuba mask.
A lovely mechanic you told me early on really stuck with me was the fact that if you can't afford to pay for something, then you either lose points or, you know, you have to make a bank transfer.
Yes.
And that just means like spending two money to move for each room you move money from.
Yeah, if you want to move your money from your R&D department to your HR department, you've got to move the money, but you have to pay $2 in credit
card fees.
And
you end up doing it, but it's horrible.
Yeah,
and it's a lovely board game horrible, you know, being like, I've not got that right. But at the same time, I went, you know, traditional route, I just got lots of workers.
Yeah.
I went and hired as many people as
you
I could.
You went crazy for workers.
I love, if it's a worker placement game, give me them extra workers.
Give me more boys.
All right. I'm like praying for children here. Like seriously begging for children. Give me the workers. But then in this, having to pay for them was kind of brutal. Mm-hmm. Every time you said at the start of a round, like the end of the round, like it was time to pay the workers, I was audibly sighing.
Mm.
Like,
you know, yeah.
It was really causing you to raise some serious questions about my ethics. Big landlord energy.
Yeah, it ratchets up so quickly when you start getting more of those workers. Because like the cheapest, worst treasure chest you can sells for like $6, $5, bucks, something like that. And by the end, we were paying $8 a round for our big set of
workers. I was paying
10. Yeah, it gets so expensive so quickly.
Just to have employees? Are you kidding me?
We actually pursued really interesting avenues in this game. Like I went mad for basically filling this museum with bad treasure. Mm-hmm. I just got the cheapest, most rubbish treasure I could and just threw it at the museum, scraping by, just getting a tiny bit of money, but taking up all the room in the prestigious place where you're meant to get points.
Which is, again, it's a funny, stupid idea. You know, the idea that like you turn up with a genuine, priceless treasure and then the museum's like, no, sorry, no.
We've already opened this room.
We've not got any room.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we filled it with these bits of copper.
So I was busy doing that, whereas you were on the other side of the board just going absolutely hog wild for getting more boats.
Yes.
I had one boat for the entire game. One boat that I'd put my little fella on. He'd go out into the ocean. He'd bring me back maybe a treasure, maybe a shark, maybe some random stuff from a lagoon. But for you, you had three boats doing different jobs at all times, playing your own personal boat management game.
And I think partially that was because the little wooden boaty things that you put your meeples
into. They're really good.
And move them around. They were really cool. Yeah. And it was the fact that, you know, rather than it being like, oh, I'm the red player, which means I get a second red boat. Mm-hmm. Like, no, you start with a boat that's the color that you are, but then afterwards there's just different colors of boats.
Yeah. Do you want the purple boat?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I was like having a great time being like, well, I'm going to buy the pink boat and then I'm going to buy the yellow boat.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to enjoy the colorful boats that I have.
And there's a really interesting little, or just very tactile, very pleasing kind of specialization game you play where a lot of the game revolves around buying these technologies that will help you dive deeper on certain spaces or give you sonar or drilling equipment so you can get stuff out from underground or like harpoons and cages for massacring many, many sharks. I'm not sure about this game's relationship with the sharks of the ocean.
We'll come back to the sharks in a minute, yeah, because it was odd.
It was very odd.
It was a bit weird.
But you will get these technologies. You'll patent them. You'll develop them. Other people have to pay you if you patent them first. It's quite a chunky bit of game. But what's cute about it is that you'll then equip your boats with the things that you patented. So you had a little boat that had a little guy with a lobster pot on it.
Yeah.
And every round you sent him out to go and get you some lobster, which got you a little bit of cash.
Got me loads of money.
Which you then used to pay your workers.
Yeah, it was great. Like, and honestly, it was one, the fact that you then had to budget ahead of time and make a plan meant it was very enjoyable. Because often with this kind of game, I really like to try and scrimp and save and like, you know, get that razor edge wire of being like, can I spend all of my money exactly? Because then it's like optimal. Mm-hmm. Whereas in this, trying to do that is very dangerous, especially because of the fact that, as I say, you're putting the workers down and you're not doing the action straight away. You're doing the action when it then gets round to that action after everyone's placed, which means things can change. Mm-hmm. And you're suddenly in a position where things aren't as juicy as you wanted or the thing that you wanted to happen before this, et cetera, et cetera. And because of that, I mean, I loved having loads of money and watching you not have any
money. You had tons of money.
Because you were really stressing out about where to put the budget. And I was just like sprinkling it on like haphazardly, like a toddler decorating a cake.
I was like,
I'll put some more money. There.
Every dollar was accounted for in my company. I had to keep it to the wire.
I wasn't even counting. Towards the end, I was just like, I put a big pile in the staff zone.
Yeah.
I knew I was going to need it. And then everything else was just like,
you don't mind paying the bank transfer fees because you just had
I did. Yeah, I was like, I got cash. Don't worry about it.
It genuinely looked like at the end of the game, it looked like you were going to rely on the victory condition or not the victory condition, sorry, the end game scoring condition of you get a point for every 10 money you
have.
It like that was going to be your avenue to winning the game was going to be, I'll just get a bunch of points because I have so much money.
It might have been a good one. I mean, I think what I'd say about this game is, you know, we didn't have a perfect game of it. We played it once and we got a couple of things slightly muddled. It's a pretty resilient design though.
Yes.
In terms of the fact that like, you know, there were a few things that we started to clock. Is this quite right? And we're like, okay. But actually the things we got wrong didn't really impact the game dramatically.
No.
We had a nice time with it. And it was a kind of like slightly silly, I don't know if it was trying to be slightly silly, but it felt like a sort of slightly silly simulation-y era.
Yeah.
Era of like, the theme of it was fun. I immediately, because I love playing in the space, the idea is you get a treasure map and then you can go and dive in these different areas of the sea with a boat.
Yeah.
I immediately went and spent all of my money buying almost all of the treasure maps. I just went and monopolized the treasure maps. And gamed that system to make it so that all of the treasure maps I'd left were incredibly expensive.
Yeah.
And then it meant like I didn't really have any boats, but you're out at sea, but you couldn't really do much. While I was just running around with all these maps being like, you'll never find me treasure.
There were so many like fun little angles and like strange little parts where you can kind of do a bit of player expression. I really enjoyed the round where you bought a patent for a diving helmet,
yep,
and then bought all the available stock of that diving helmet, so I just could never have it.
No.
And so there were certain parts of the map where I could just never dive, like I could never go there. Not that I was that into the idea of doing that. I was having a lot of fun splishing around in the shallows, dredging up rubbish, which I was selling for a little bit of money.
Yeah, and you could deal with sharks, and I didn't really have any ability to deal with sharks, which really limited my treasure ability.
That's true.
The shark system was very strange, and I think that's really where the game must know that it's slightly silly, and the fact that some of the treasures are like underneath a little shark, and the treasure areas, like when you go into these parts of the sea, it's like a grid.
Yeah.
And then the grid is basically showing you like, you know, different levels of depth and different levels of object. And then like sometimes you need like sonar to get treasure. Sometimes the treasures are buried under the thing and you need a tool that can dig.
If they're really low down, you need a big fancy diving helmet. If they're right near the surface, then you just need maybe a little tiny oxygen mask.
Just a bit of chutzpah.
A snorkel. Some shorts.
But then getting treasures that were underneath sharks, you had to have something to try and get rid of the shark / kill the shark.
Yes.
Otherwise, no treasure for you. There's a shark. But the system was kind of strange in the fact that you just needed like a harpoon gun or something, and then you could get past the shark. But every time you did it, you rolled a die. And if you got a good enough result, then you might kill the shark. And then you take it back to your shark abattoir.
And you go, wahoo!
Right? And so it was basically like you roll a dice and you might get two more points.
Yeah.
Now, there was a mechanic in this, so you could get a shark cage if you wanted to, and then not fight the sharks and just ignore them. Fine. But it did feel strange that like the margin at the end of the game was not that far off, that at one point I tried to kill a shark and rolled a one, which was improbably the only thing I could have rolled at that point that wouldn't do it.
Yes.
And then you just rolled like a five and a six back to back.
I just got four free points.
And that was the difference in points.
Yeah.
Was I was just rolling a dice three times.
Matt, I think you'll find it was all skill at that point.
But no, I mean, it's one of those things where I didn't care, but I thought, wow, like for a game like this big, like with this many little cubes,
it was
and stuff,
a really, really strange bit of game where you went down there with a shark cage and a harpoon gun.
Yep.
And you were like, hopefully I'll get one by the end of this game. And you didn't get any.
No.
Whereas I went down there with the most minimal protection possible and got two in a row.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, that is like a huge amount of like freak luck for me to get.
Yeah.
But still, like the fact that that was the point differential at the end of the game is enough to probably turn a few people off this game entirely.
Yes. And I think like I'm comfortable with a bit of wildness. In fact, I think like I sort of jokingly at one point said this is like the great Western legend of the sea.
You mean Western Legends?
That's it, sorry.
Yeah.
I'm getting Great Western Trail mixed up.
You're portmanteauing them together. I love it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, no, it is. It's like Western Legends. It's like choose your kind of avenue to become water famous. Wet famous.
Wet and famous.
It's like maybe I'm going to just go really, really hard on just expunging the sea of every shark that ever lived. Or maybe I'm going to actually do my job and get treasure using sonar.
And I kind of, in a way, wish it had gone more that direction. There's a couple of things that I would have done. Like, at the end of the game, we realized that you'd basically just done a savvy thing of jumping in and doing some advertising, which was basically just worker placement where you got loads of points.
I didn't even get that many.
It was like eight.
It's just an option where you just go and you spend money to get points, and that's it.
Which is, again, a kind of mechanic in a game that's so, like, otherwise quite thematic. I'm like, what the heck is that about? Like, take that out of here. This is just...
I think the idea is that it's meant to look really lucrative early on in the game, and then it gets less good over the course of the game. And it's like, well, if you take the risk early on and do a bunch of advertising, but it's still like, it doesn't thematically hang together.
No, it doesn't. But I like the way that you had one of your workers, a bit like in Galactic Cruise, you have one worker who is like the big worker.
Yeah.
The boss.
The boss.
And that's fun because the boss gets bonuses. Mm-hmm. But it has a little thing where if you take the boss and a junior person to the same worker placement area and you're the first person to do it, you train them up and they get a little hat, which makes that person like as if they are the boss, but only for that kind
specific
of job
area. Yeah, yeah.
Still though, I found that a lot of fun, and it's really enjoyed putting the hats on people. We kind of started giving them stupid names.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like actually the game would, I wonder how much better the game would be if instead of the hats just being these flat things that have numbers on them that is the number of the action on the board, if they'd given them slightly thematic hats,
right,
then I feel like at that point I would have liked the game a lot more.
Yeah, like, yeah.
a little Indiana Jones hat for the maps.
Can I make a kind of wild comparison here? Is that I actually think that this game, more than anything, kind of reminds me of that game Rock Hard that we played a while ago. That was the game about being a rock star, and it was like a worker placement game, but about like making music. And I spent the whole game toiling away in the studio. You spent the whole game partying.
I don't know. I think that's I get what you mean. I think that's a cruel comparison because I think Rock Hard was like really unhinged in terms of it having its like chance cards and stuff like that.
But I guess what I'm saying is that this feels like a super flavorful Euro game that I've played once and I don't know if I necessarily need to go back and play it again. I think that's where the kind of common ground sits between them. In that this is a game that has those edges of being like frothy and silly, but it is more robust as a game design at its core. But still, the feeling afterwards didn't have me like jumping in, wanting to go in again.
I think that's it. I think it's like it's definitely a lot more robust than Rock Hard, which I thought was frankly just a bit of a mess. But like, but yeah, it walked that weird line of not being quite like thematic enough to feel like a little adventure-y game.
Yeah,
but then also not feeling quite as robust enough to be like a really like a crunchy Euro that you'd really want to keep playing and playing and playing.
Yeah. And I think a lot of my frustration with this game is kind of exacerbated by the fact that the manual was absolutely appalling.
It doesn't help.
It's a truly, truly shocking bit of manual that meant that led to us playing the game in all these fuzzy, strange ways because it just doesn't give you enough clarification when it needs to.
And again, I think, you know, we kept searching for the manual, trying to work out the rule about treasure being not on the boat. Because in the end, it's like, it does seem like when you get treasure out at sea, it just teleports back to your player board in a way that I'm like, but they're out at sea.
It's because your little boat that you send out has like slots for the equipment, which are these little square spaces. And then the treasure is also a nice little square space. But as far as we could tell, it just teleports back to your base immediately. And you can then sell it to the museum on the same day, which is strange because everything else in the game has you returning to port to like put new equipment on your boat. I don't know. Honestly,
like I had fun with it, but yeah, I get it. It didn't feel like it was exciting enough or that there would be enough like variance to keep digging back and back to like find things and play again and again. But I had a fun time with it.
It was a fun,
weird thematic thing.
Well, yeah, really strange bit of game. Next up on the podcast, we have Tenby. This is another 2025 game designed by Benji Talbot with art by Benji Talbot and published by Mighty Boards. This is a game where you're making the wonderful city of Tenby out of cards.
Mm.
And not a very sturdy construction material. It might fall down.
Yeah. And this is about the nice little Welsh town by the sea.
Yeah.
Which if you do rock up to it in the height of the summer with harpoons and diving suits and trying to murder things in the sea.
You will be turned away.
They don't like it.
They don't like it.
But if you just want an ice cream.
Oh, maybe
and
spot
to look
a seagull.
At some colourful buildings. very pleasant indeed.
I like this game quite a lot.
It's very sweet
and
crunchy.
Yes. Kind of the perfect combination. It looks on the surface to be a nice little sweet, gentle time, and you're going to have an easy game. And then you start playing and you go,
I feel like if you didn't have our particular type of broken, spicy board game brains, though, that you probably would just have a really nice, chill time. Because on paper, all you're doing is you are taking cards from these little shops. You've got some buildings, you've got some pier bits, and all you have to do is take a building, take a thing, and then place it into one of four different streets that you're making. So at any point, you start off with, you're making a first street, and then if you want to make a new one, you can make a new street.
You have a new street.
And then all you have to do is just put it next to another card in a way that is legal. And basically, you've got bits of these cards that are either like, it's a high building, or it's a little bit of pier, or it's a building becoming a pier, etc. Yes. It's the end of a building coming down and then pier. So as long as you can put it next to it and it's either a wall or
a pier,
that's fine. That's
legal. It. That's allowed. You can do that.
You can do that.
But all of these buildings and all of these piers have a little scoring criteria on them. And the scoring criteria will look at the adjacent cards and say, how many of this thing are on your cards next to me? So for example, you might have a bit of pier that has a picture of a seagull and it says 1 point next to it, which means if you look at the two cards next to that bit of pier, you just count up the seagulls. You know, normally we're used to games having like specific icons for these things.
Yeah.
You know, they'll say like in Cascadia or something, it'll be like how many, you know, fox icons are next to you or how many of this specific symbol. It's kind of delightful in this game that they've kind of littered the little bits of stuff that you need to look for on these cards kind of around the card.
Yeah.
It's like, how many clouds are there? And it's literally how many individual drawings of clouds are on this card.
You feel like you're doing like Spot the Difference or something. It feels like it should be like an activity for small children.
Yeah.
Being like, oh, how many little lobster cages are there?
You know,
how many?
We'll come back to this later, but it could be an activity for small children.
I think,
because of all of...
Because of the special rules.
The special rules. Yeah. We'll get back to that later.
We'll get back to the special rules later. But I mean, honestly, it could have been an activity for small children if I'd allowed my brain to switch off as well. But I was really trying to crunch it and max it. Because yes, you have cards that are like, oh, you get a point for every seagull adjacent to this card. Mm-hmm. But then you have cards that are like, you get a point for every cloud adjacent to this card. In two cards either direction. So then you're like, whoa, there's four cards. You could really optimize the clouds in the sky there. You might get 12 points maybe, I don't know. And then you have cards that are special that be like all the way down, like you have these special, like, kind of, I want to say artifacts,
landmarks
that'll be like, hey, you count up all of the cozy buildings on this whole row,
every single house is gonna get you 2 points.
Whoa.
And the thing that's interesting about all of this is that they come in these little markets that you have in front of you. And it has this interesting... I reviewed Railroad Tiles recently, and it has a system that's very evocative of Railroad Tiles. The first player in turn order will choose one of these action cards that will tell them how many of each kind of card they get to put into their tableau this round. So, for example, I might be going first in turn order, and I pick the card that gives me two buildings and a pier, and then I will place them away. But then there is another action card that's a little bit worse, but to the left of it, and there's another action card that's a little bit better to the right of it. And Matt has the choice of whether he wants to go first in turn order next round, taking a worse action, or later in turn order, but getting more cards.
Mm.
And the interesting thing about this as well is that each of these different card markets is kind of varied depending on the quality of the card.
Yes.
So the buildings, which, you know, are your sort of bread and butter, there's always three cards to choose from. Then there's only ever two pier cards in the market, and only ever one landmark card.
Mm.
And so if you're going to go for the landmark this round, you need to know that you really want it, and the action needs to arrive at the right time. Or there's a little bit of bendiness in there because you have these life rings you can spend for extra actions.
Yeah, the life rings really like help a lot
in
terms of just being able to like, okay, you can spend this like economy to just do wild actions at any point.
Yes.
And especially useful when you think, oh God, I need to do that now. I need to grab that thing from the shop.
Mm-hmm.
I really like the whole like bidding for the turn order and getting actions for it at the same time. Kind of like in King Domino, really, actually, of the way that you are just flipping cards and then putting them in numerical order, which means you do have some rounds where you go, well, that's a really, really crap card.
Yeah.
But if you take that, you get to go first. Mm-hmm. But then the one that makes you last might be like incredible.
Yeah. Yes.
Versus rounds where you have like, well, they're all kind of all good or they're all crap.
Yeah, they're all kind of bunched, and being able to assess how valuable turn order is in that moment is really crucial.
And like you maintain control of turn order for a long time.
Yeah, I was ruthless.
You were ruthless
about it. Did not get me the win though.
No, it didn't. But like honestly, it was stressful because it kept realizing that like, okay, you're gonna go first, you're gonna take two of those like building cards, and then there's not gonna be any in the market for me.
Yeah.
And then I'm gonna have to spend my precious little life rings to just, if I want to top deck a few more,
to see more cards. Yeah.
I had the problem of I kept going, you know what? I'm just going to top deck something and then you have to place it. And like, I did it twice and couldn't place anything.
Yeah.
And it was like, you know.
I was like, do you just want to make a new street with this?
No.
No.
So I was very much in the finding out phase, but you know, I kind of liked that. I was like, I was really gambling. I was like, I'm going to take a top card and then be like, oh, it doesn't work. There was a lovely kind of flow to the game. And I like the fact that, you know, we had that thing at the start of getting a card that's kind of an objective card for the game.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And having the objective system, having a thing where, like, you basically get points for, like, if you've finished a street or not. So, like, you want to kind of try and get these objectives. And again, it's stuff like, have a street that has 10 lampposts on it.
Mm-hmm.
So I enjoy the kind of micro and the macro of it.
Yeah, and the sort of push your luck as well of like, there were many times in which I knew that I should probably finish the street that I was working on.
Yeah.
But what if I squeezed another little building on there to get a few more points?
Especially because it's that like adjacency bonus thing. Mm-hmm. You're like, oh, cool. Okay, well, that's got lampposts on it, so I'll put that there. Great. And then you're like, oh, well, the bonus on that card wants benches. And then you're like, oh, a card with benches on it. And then you just like keep chaining together these like adjacency bonuses until you're like, what am I doing here?
Yeah,
like,
well, exactly.
This is a silly
this
street.
This is a wreck.
But no, I like the fact that, you know, you have these objective cards that you can get more of that are much broader and are just like, hey, just get this many of this thing or do this thing on a street.
They give you some direction.
It means you can just play it like that. You don't have to get lost in the weeds of like trying to maximize every single card. Like when I was going through and scoring each card, I think I had one card that didn't get me any points, mm-hmm. and it felt bad.
Yeah.
But it was, otherwise it was nice. And some of them were getting me like 6 or 9. And I was like, ooh. Yeah, there's money in benches, son. Yeah, it's lovely. Like it definitely was like hurting my brain more than I expected.
Yeah.
But
yeah, for the size of box and the presentation being as cute as it is, you think this is going to be a lot easier than it is as a game. And then when you sit down to play it, it will hit you on the skull. Repeatedly.
But in kind of a hilarious way. And one of those things that I love in board games where you sit there and go, oh boy, I'm really crunching here. And then at one point you like point over at me and like, what are you doing? And I'm literally just pointing and moving. I'm like, I'm counting clouds. And it's like, literally I'm like counting cartoon clouds.
I got to get my benches in order.
And like, yeah, very, very sweet. I think it would be interesting, like with more people, especially like in terms of the trying to get that turn order and lock it in and hold on to that crown. And as you said, there's like some really fun variants in it. So that we've seen a few games doing this. I think the new Cascadia that's coming out shortly or is out, I'm not sure about timing on that, has another mode like that as well,
sure.
where you can play a simplified version of the game
with
kids or, you know, people who are exhausted. This has a similar thing, right?
Yeah, it's kind of fascinating, actually, because it's not just a simpler version of Tenbi, the game that we just played.
Mm.
It has a whole bunch of different rules variants for different levels of complexity that are, like, entirely different games, but they just use the same cards. And I haven't looked thoroughly at these, but I'm sure some of them are just, like, spot the difference, almost. They're just, like, look at these little seagulls and chimneys for kids to play. But then there's also the complicated Tenbi game of Tenbi that you can play using the same components. It's really interesting. I've not seen a game do that before where it's like, look, you can just use these to play all these strange little sort of random games that we've chucked in the box as well for if you're dealing with a table perhaps that has mixed abilities around the table, or if you just want to pretend to a child that they're playing the same game you're playing.
Yeah, I honestly think the latter. I think it's nice to have a thing that's a cute little box that, like, especially with something like that, there's nothing worse than when, like, you know, I guess it's cruel, but I think, you know, it's, I enjoy anime, but I hate the idea of having a situation where you have some anime related thing and a child comes up and goes, oh, this looks fun. And you'd be like, no, you cannot. This is not for you. Like, there's something about like having something that looks fun and cute and then saying, no, keep away from that.
Yeah.
Keep away from my pristine Pokemon card collection. It's like, it feels wrong.
Yeah.
And this game looks so fun and childlike and cartoonish that if a kid wants to play it,
they should be, like, allowed.
Yeah, they should be allowed.
And they shouldn't go through crunch hell.
No, but also I think, like, I do like the idea of manuals just having a little thing being like almost like a suggestion in a box of like how to do that, like, kid at the arcade who doesn't have any money mode.
Controller not plugged in.
Yeah, like, so you can be like, all right, we want to play this crunchy game.
Yeah.
We have a kid who wants to play as well. They definitely can't.
Yeah.
But like, what can we do that makes them feel like they're doing it?
Yeah.
So on their turn, they're doing something that looks like what we're doing, but it's not actually impacting us. And I like that. I think it's good.
Hmm. I think that all of the little extra games in Tenbi should have a sort of like realism factor below them. How much does the child think that they're really playing the game you're playing right now?
And then you have the recession legacy mode for super turbo adults. We're just like crossing things out. All of the birds have died because of pollution.
Oh no.
No, don't make that version. Please stop.
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 And that is this week's episode of the Shut Up and Sit Down podcast. We talked about Thesaurus. We talked about Tenbi. Mm. Two very different games.
Yep.
Both beside the sea.
But both a bit wet.
Both a bit wet. If you want to hear about more wet games, then you can go back and listen to the episode The Big Wet Sprint, where me and Matt talked about Magical Athlete and Hot Streak and 12 Rivers.
There's a whole
bunch of racing games to do with water, but not at all.
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah.
Kind of. I mean, Hot Streak's got a hot dog in it, and you put mustards on that, and mustards are almost water.
Mustard's a form of wet. And then there's the skipper in Magical Athlete.
Yep.
He is presumably driving a boat.
He's more than a form of wet.
Boat go on
He's
wet.
He's wet all the way through.
Few people are that.
You cut him, he bleeds wet.
Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
Bye.